Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. How are you today? It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood here, except for this awful echo in my headphones. But thank you so much for being here with us. Let me welcome my guests. Matt Hodges here with us. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Rick.
Charlottesville sales manager from the Presidential Bank Mortgage.
You got it.
And Jim Duncan, realtor, broker, partner with Ness Realty.
Morning, Rick. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks to the both of you for being here.
Thank you.
All right. So we are going to talk about local economy and real estate with our guests. For those of you out there who aren't aware, long time friends here of Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Guys, let's take a look back at 2016 for a minute. Jim, you always have that phrase about, and I can't say it properly, but something about when people ask you to look forward, come back to you in 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always, you know, I say that I'm always looking for hindsight, if you will, trying to project forward. And when people ask me about how is the market doing now, my response typically starts with, one, it depends, and two, I'll let you know in 18 months.
So how did 2016 do in terms of what you thought, how you thought it might?
A lot of market segments within Charlottesville, Albemarle specifically, and the Central Virginia region as a whole did quite well, relatively. I mean, I've been doing this for, I think, 15 years. So, you know, I'm always sort of hedging a little bit because having come out of a crash, I'm always a little bit on edge. But on a whole, the market values went up across the board. Days on market were down year over year, and you know, it sounds, you know, simplistic, but the market as a whole was good for most sellers and a lot of buyers. I've been hitting this for years now. I mean, I think one of the healthiest things that I've seen from my lens is that a lot of the buyers now are looking for horizons of, you know, 7 to 10 years to 15 to 20 years, rather than 0 to 5 years when they would move to Charlottesville and sell in 2 years.
You said most sellers and a lot of buyers. So right. What I hear there is that sellers did pretty well and buyers, but you got a house.
Well, I mean, you know, it really does depend. I mean, saying anything about the market as a whole is short-sighted and simplistic. I mean, I think that you have to look at the micro markets in which these buyers bought. I mean, if a buyer came in and bought a new construction home and they were happy with it, and they're planning to be there for a significant period of time, you know, I think that they're going to have a new product that's going to be in a good location with nice, you know, energy efficiencies and all of that. So, I mean, I think that they're always looking at housing from a residential perspective, from an investment point of view. But I think a lot of people shifted over to focusing more on the intrinsic value of the home and the stability. You know, I've had clients tell me, you know, after they move from renting to home ownership, they're able to say, I know where my kids are going to go to school, not just, you know, in pre-K and kindergarten, but I know where they're going to go to school in high school. And I think that that's a value that it's hard to quantify in a dollars and cents, and more of a, you know, a sigh of relief from a parenting perspective.
Matt, how about for you from the Matt Hodges with Presidential Bank Mortgage? Is it similar when you look back at 2016 from your part of the industry as it is with Jim's, or do things change a little bit once you get to the mortgage part of it?
Yeah, it's a little difficult to compare the buyer when I'm speaking with them as to when Jim's working with them. They're working through a lot of the issues with lack of inventory that's out there, deciding where they're going to live. I'm dealing more with the mechanics of how they're going to get into the house. Broadly, 2016 was exactly what I thought it would be. Our numbers were almost spot on, slightly higher than I expected, but not much. Interest rates helped throughout that whole process, although we did have a significant change around the election time with interest rates. But overall, clients got what they were looking for. It was a positive year, and in fact, I'm looking for a very good 2017 as well.
We'll get into 2017 as well. Again, our guest today here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, Matt Hodges, Jim Duncan. We'll be talking about the local economy and Charlottesville, Central Virginia real estate. This is 94.7 WPVC. You can find Jim Duncan's well-known blog, realcentralva.com. Some of the topics today he will have written about in the past, in the recent past, and usually covers some of what we talk today in an upcoming blog. One of the things that I saw recently, Jim, that you talked about was the lack of quality inventory recently. Talk about that. Get us started.
When I say these things, you know, please hear that I'm saying the micro markets in certain segments with that preface. But as a general rule, right now, inventory in the city and the urban ring is very, very low. I mean, there is a lot of competition for homes right now, and we're only in January. We've struggled with a lack of inventory for the last few years with buyers who are coming in. And you might have if you're coming in with a 60-day window to find a home, you may have 30 to 40 homes from which to choose during that time frame. So it can be a real struggle and challenge for buyers who are going to necessarily have to compromise with their home search and what they end up buying. And I think compromising is not necessarily a bad thing. I've had, I think, one client in 15 years who says that she got everything that she wanted. But everybody else makes compromises. But the inventory is a challenge, and I think that it's an affordability issue, it's a supply issue, but ultimately I think you could look at through one lens as being a good sign. Charlottesville, Albemarle are desirable places to live. People choose to move here. People choose to stay here. They call it the hook for a reason. I mean, there are a lot of people who go to high school here. They go away, live their lives, start their families, and then come back. So there is, we still remain a very desirable place to be, and that increased demand, is necessarily challenging the supply that we have, because delivering supply, under 400, under 500 can be really, really challenging in the city and the county of Albemarle, and so you find people are going to be looking again to go out to the surrounding counties. But delivering new supply to the market is at a quote unquote affordable rate is a perennial challenge.
Rick, right now, this year has started off so hot with new pre-qualifications. On a daily basis, I'm fielding 2 to 5 to more inquiries about buying this season. I've always said that the spring market starts around January 15th. And for the next 60 days, between the 15th and the 15th of March, we're going to see a lot of inventory come online. The question that I have right now is, are the sellers going to come out? Are they going to provide inventory for my buyers because they don't have it yet? The number of clients that I have in a pre-qual state, the significant amount, they cannot find the property yet.
I mean, a lot of it's like the Aesop's fable, where you have the dog with the bone in his mouth, and he's looking down over the bridge in the pond below, and he wants that other bone but doesn't want to release the one in his mouth. That's a lot of buyers or a lot of buyers and sellers. I mean, a lot of sellers, they want to buy another home, but they can't make that move until they've sold their existing home. And making an offer on another house that is contingent on the sale of a house, when you're faced with competition of possibly 2-3 other offers, that puts that seller or that prospective buyer in a difficult spot. So it really is, I think that is a good analogy of a lot of people in the Charlottesville-Albemarle market, because there's still quite a bit of competition, and they could sell their house. Probably they could probably sell their house with some efficiency, but they might not be able to move anywhere.
But is that give us a good market because we could do these things, because the market is so strong that you could sell it because of all the pre-qualifications, that our real estate market and our local economy are so strong that there is low inventory? Or is that saying that our local market is not that great because there's not enough inventory for people who want to move here, for people who want to sell their home to buy another to release what they have because there's so little to choose from at this point?
Yes.
Yeah, very, very good point. There's an inefficiency in the marketplace right now, and my hope is that it corrects itself in the next 60 days.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very salient point. But I think that you're right in both. I think it's a sign of a very healthy and strong real estate market in the Charlottesville region. It also presents some significant challenges for people who are looking to, trade in that equity that they have in their home and apply it to the next property. There are some logistical challenges in there that, are very difficult to overcome.
It's almost like you need a barter system. And I don't want to take, obviously not trying to take the two of you out of the system. Again, our guest, Matt Hodges, Jim Duncan. But you almost want to walk down, go to the area where you live and want to walk down and knock on doors and saying, hey, anybody looking to sell your house? Because I have one over here. And therefore, you're not putting yourself out until you actually find somebody who has yet to put themselves out either.
Mm-hmm. That happens.
Yeah. That does happen. I would say that may be a wee bit more inefficient than what we currently have.
Granted.
You hear stories of that happening, of house swaps and things of that nature. But it really is, it is a perennial challenge as to how, a seller is going to sell, this home here and buy the next home, without having that assurance that they can get another house, because the home buying process is necessarily a truncated one for most people. That again, I think it's really important to know that you're looking at, when you're going to buy a home, you have the opportunity to see maybe 30, 50 homes that are going to be in your particular market segment for that, 60, 90 day window. So I think that, again, it goes to, I tell all my buyers that as they find, they may find that house that they love or they'd like kind of a little bit, but they still make an offer on it. Make that offer confident that they're going to be happy in that home, because as soon as they make an offer and it gets ratified, put under contract, invariably another one will come on the market tomorrow that they think they might like better. So it really is, it takes a lot of, for my role as a buyer's agent, it takes a lot of guidance for these people to understand, the market and what their decision-making process looks like.
Sunday morning wake-up call. I'm Rick Moore. Our guest today, Jim Duncan, Nest Realty, Matt Hodges, Presidential Bank Mortgage. You were talking about the fact that there's really currently, anyway, low inventory. Mm-hmm. And sort of my goal at the moment to understand why that is, did something start the low inventory? Did it just happen? Because one of the things is, someone who spent a long time having to find a new place to rent, was not looking to buy, and conversations with people brought up whether it was factual information, true fact, or whether it's one of those things where you hear it from one person and then you extrapolate it to being unfairly applied in a grander scheme, that people are renting their homes rather than selling them. Because they can get them on the tourist, scheme for, was it Airbnb, or similar situations, things like that. Is Are there issues of that sort that have slowed down or dropped the sales, the house sales? Is there something that started the low inventory?
Well, you know, part of the issue is the rate of return for your investment. And right now, rents are increasing. The return can be better for a landlord than selling the property, taking a profit, flipping it into a new property. That's probably one small portion of the issue right now, is that rents are increasing and that rate of return is better for the investor.
I mean, I think that the... You know, why is inventory low? First, you know, we are in January. So in my show notes, I'll put up a chart that I've done for a few years of when do homes come on the market in Charlottesville. The peak of new inventory to the market is March. So we're still ramping up the 2017 real estate season. So again, with that caveat. But I think it goes back to demand. I mean, people want to live here. A lot of people target Charlottesville, Albemarle as a great place to live, and they come here, and they keep their jobs in whatever locality from which they move, and they keep that job there, and they move to Charlottesville, Albemarle, and so long as it has broadband, which is a massive, you know, massive thing for most of my buyers, they keep their job where they are, and they live here. So I think that, as I've been living in Charlottesville for almost 30 years, and we've heard it for years, we're a victim of our own success to a certain degree. You know, I love living here. I've raised a family here. It's great. You know, I don't have any intention to move. In that vein, I'm kind of contributing to the lack of inventory because I'm choosing to not sell my house. But really, it's people love living here, and we are not able to deliver sufficient supply to meet the demand. And I think that's part of it is, you know, one thing that I think that we need to look at from a region perspective is that, you know, we need to, as a community, seek to bring in more jobs, you know, more ladder type economies, so that people can come in and they can start, you know, at the low rung and work their way up over many years. And I think that that's part of the challenge as well, is we need to look at it not just as a housing perspective, but a holistic economy perspective, that, you know, the county, you know, specifically needs to work very hard to make it more business friendly. I was talking to a friend the other day. He has a business in a neighboring community, and he said that, you know, it's a great place to have a business because if his gross receipts are under a certain threshold, he does not pay business taxes, which keeps his business there and allows him to hire employees and keep them and have a prosperous business. I mean, that's the sort of thing that I think that we need to look at from a community perspective is, you know, what can we do to make it more business friendly so we can have more jobs, so we can, you know, afford these houses more effectively. So I think it's something we really need to look at, not just from a, you know, Sunday perspective or Monday or Tuesday, but long term. What are we as a community and what are we as a government going to do to make it and keep it a great place to live and work?
11:20 here on Sunday morning, wake up call. All right, back with our guests today, Jim Duncan, Matt Hodges, talking about local economy and real estate. Guys, you know, Matt, you touched on it briefly as we were getting started and on looking back in 2016. You mentioned how, from your perspective, things were nice and steady until the election took place and then rates changed a little bit. Talk about what happened then. And then we can talk a bit more about that.
Sure, yeah. So we were fairly steady in the mid to upper 3% range for a 30-year fix. So, 3.5, 3.625. The election occurred the day after rates spiked, went up a quarter to 3/8 in rate. It was a significant movement. It was a totally unexpected result for the election. And the thought was from bond traders is that the policies for Trump's administration would be inflationary. inflationary trends tend to push interest rates up long term. Economy's booming. There's a better rate of return for investments. So that was one of the pieces. The second is the Fed, the Federal Reserve, meets about every 6 weeks, and they were looking to push up short-term lending rate. And it was a very high percentage that they would do so, but in fact they did. And then they further said that there were going to be three increases of the short-term lending rate this coming year. Now, keep in mind, last December they said there would be four. There was one. So the Fed tends to overshoot on where they think things are going, both for improvements in employment, inflation goals, things like that. The third piece was the European Central Bank. Okay, so why the heck do we care in the United States about Europe? Well, because we're part of a global economy. And the ECB, much like the Fed, was putting money into sovereign bonds. So they would purchase Italian bonds, German bonds, in order to have that liquidity, have monies to put into infrastructure investments. But unlike the Fed, they also bought corporate bonds as well. Well, come March, this coming March, they decided to start tapering that purchase from 80 billion euros to 60 billion euros. Whenever there's a tapering and there's less money going into the marketplace, it becomes more illiquid and the price goes up. The price goes down, the yield goes up. That hurts interest rates. And further, they said, hey, we're going to stop buying bonds altogether in December of this year. So 1 year out, they're already predicting what they would do. All of that sort of snowballed on us and pushed interest rates up well past 4%, up to 4 3/8 or so. It has since modified or reduced down to about 4 1/8 roughly now for a 30-year fixed. That had a chilling effect on some buyers and almost all refinances. Refinances just stopped. Now, we don't care about that for this program. We care about what the state of the real estate market is. But it did have an effect on buyers and what they were thinking about for affordability. That interest rate movement can be significant for someone's household. If you look at simply a $300,000 mortgage from where we were to where we are today, that's $128 a month. And that can be significant for both qualifying and for your cash flow. What do you have left at the end of the day in order to buy groceries, to go out to a movie?
That's a lot of cash.
It's a lot of cash.
I mean, and I think, you know, sort of quick divergent from that, when I advise my buyers, you know, we look at the total cost of ownership. You look at that $128 a month, that's a couple tanks of gas. You know, that's, you know, so you look at, when you make that buying decision, I try to advise them to look at what they're, I call them the triangles, you know, the work, home, grocery, or whatever those data points are. Try to live within a reasonable distance so that they're spending less money on transportation costs and they're able to apply more of that to mortgage, food, fun, what have you. So it, again, it's something that it's easy to go on, you know, go onto the internet and find a mortgage calculator, but it doesn't actually calculate, you know, all of the stuff that is comprised when you look at my mortgage is going to be X, but my cost to own this house is going to be Y. And if we look at, you know, energy efficiency and utility costs and transportation costs and all of these things all factor in. And so when I think that when buyers and any of us look at what the, you know, what interest rates are doing, it's important to know that that does have an impact on affordability and on resellability and all of those things.
Well, you were talking about what happened after Election Day, Matt, but there have also been conversations about what may happen after Inauguration Day, correct? There have been, or at least what I've read, headline-wise, is that there have been talk about moving Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac into the private sector.
Yeah, you know, that's a longer-term goal for the federal government. I don't know, and I have not read what Trump's administration has said about that. I can tell you what's going on right now. What is pertinent to me is the HUD announced recently, Secretary Castro announced that there would be a reduction of 25 basis points on the annual cost for mortgage insurance, and the annual cost is then paid on a monthly basis. it in theory was based on analysis that HUD had done with what their insurance pool should carry on a given basis. So they need to have enough for foreclosures, for losses, to be able to pay and continue the program. They decided to drop the cost for mortgage insurance early in the week. By Thursday, the HUD secretary nominee, Ben Carson, was throwing up a red flag immediately, and he said he'd look to reverse that once confirmed. So that is a challenge in our world when that becomes so politicized versus trusting that the agency had done their analysis properly throughout the process. So it's unknown. Fannie Freddie privatization, what happens with HUD with the new administration?
No, I would say that, it's a matter that Matt and I have said for years, one of the things that we are aware of and we acknowledge as a challenge is uncertainty. Anytime you have uncertainty thrown into the market, it makes it a greater challenge for anybody involved in the market to make a wise and informed decision. I wrote a story a few weeks ago about how we need to make decisions based on the window and the snapshot of information we have available to us. I think that when I advise buyers in the next 2 weeks as to what they need to do, we'll look at what we have right in front of us, and projecting out what the next administration is going to do, it's a challenge. I think because we don't have an historical record to see what path they may go down, and so again, I hate to be a cop out, but the answer for me is even more so now is, what's the market doing and what should I do? I'll let you know in 18 months once we have that hindsight. So I think it's important for us to look at what the news is coming out from Carson and HUD and the other agencies and try and figure out what's going to be a good decision for buyers and sellers right now.
11:29 here on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Guests today, Jim Duncan from Nest Realty, Matt Hodges from Presidential Bank Mortgage. We're talking about Charlottesville, Central Virginia's local economy and real estate. You can also read many of Jim Duncan's blog articles, realcentralva.com. Jim, let me ask you this, though. You say you sort of projected into the future. One of the articles I read that you had written...
Don't use my words against me.
I'd love doing this to people, though. It's one of my snarky things. I'm sure my wife would tell you, stop being so snarky like that. You had written an article about, let's go back to Charlottesville and Central Virginia, about the bus system and the court system. Tell us about that. Because this is projecting what would happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we're in a point now where, again, it, for all the years that I've lived here, the city of Charlottesville and the county of Albemarle have, I've written many times about how I think that they are sort of like divorced, estranged parents who get along just well enough to feed the kids once in a while, with the citizens being kids. It seems like they poke each other in the eye, not merely for the sake of it, but because they can. Buses. There's Charlottesville Tomorrow had an excellent, again, quick plug for Charlottesville Tomorrow, one of the finest resources we have in the community.
Sean Tubbs, scheduled to be on in March.
Yeah, Sean's fantastic. Brian, the whole staff, everybody there. No, they wrote a story about how the first one was about the county is now looking at seeing if they can get federal grants to develop their own bus system. And I don't know the underlying story behind why they would choose to do what I perceive as an absurd thing. Because I think that it's a reasonable thing for the city of Charlottesville and the county of Albemarle to, work together, seeing as how we are the same community. So I think that that's something that highlights what I perceive as a dysfunction between the city and the county. And the other one is the county of Albemarle are now in conversations and deliberations and evaluations and all their things about whether to move the courts from downtown Charlottesville to an area, to an area in the county. I think if the courts were to move from the city to the county, I think that would be a major shift in a lot, in just a lot of the logistics of, from my little lens on the world, you know, how real estate transactions are closed. You know, attorneys right now, a lot of them are close to each other. There is, and they're close to the courthouse. So there are a lot of efficiencies that are built into the those geographic logistics. But if the the courts leave downtown Charlottesville and go to the county somewhere, that's going to be, again, I think another sign of how, you know, I'd really lament the city and the county not being able to get along. And it also could be a huge positive for the county if they're able to put together an economic development solution that's going to move the courts to a place that's going to spur economic development and growth. It'd be a good thing for the county. But for me, I've written this for years that, you know, I just really wish the city and the county would get along better. I know that we're past the point of reversion and annexing and things of that nature, but I'd like to see personally, not necessarily a professional perspective, but see them merge or something to that effect so that they can have better cooperation between them. But you have a lot of egos and a lot of money that will get involved in that. So it's...
Sharing of school resources would be a great place to start.
Mm-hmm. Sharing school resources would be fantastic. You know, there's a lot of duplicity there. I think there are some efficiencies that could be realized there if we could get beyond, egos, in a lot, for lack of a better way to frame it.
If only. Jim Duncan, Matt Hodges here, as we talk about impossibilities here on the Sunday morning wake-up call.
I think one of the questions, I'll jump in, Rick, that I've gotten for years from buyers, one of our show notes leading up to this was, from an underwriting perspective, when you go and apply for a loan, it goes through the process with Matt and his team. Is it easy or hard to get a loan? From my perspective, I think that it's, I haven't applied for a loan in a number of years, but looking through the lens of my clients, it's a logistical challenge, but practically, Matt?
Yeah, it's harder. I wish I could say that the changes that Fannie and Freddie have made are making it easier and more streamlined for clients. Fannie and Freddie have come up with this theoretical reduction in paperwork where they'll do things electronically. I know no lenders that will actually implement that. They still want to verify income, asset, credit just the way they have forever. And recently, really, I don't know if it's disturbing is the right word, but Freddie Mac came up with a change to their self-employed underwriting, where for years, I've been in this business for 18 years, they have always had a one-year tax return policy if you're self-employed. If you now close after March 6th and you've been in business less than 5 years, you need 2 years of tax returns, and that's an averaging of the incomes. That's going to harm a lot of clients who would otherwise be able to purchase. And the argument I understand the other way is, well, if you can't show consistent income as a self-employed business owner, then really you shouldn't be getting a house. So I get both sides of it, but it's a huge change that has been in existence for a long time. Interestingly, on the student loan side, because that's really a hot button, is all the agencies have made it much more difficult to qualify with the student loan payments on the credit report. So if there's a zero or a deferred, we got to go to 1% of the total outstanding liens, which is not going to be an amortized loan. It's going to be much worse.
Understand that. Explain that to me.
Sure. So oftentimes on a credit report, we will see a ton of student loans. They're recently out. They're still deferred for some period of time, or even income-based repayment, IBR, we call it. And that IBR can be at zero because of the industry that they're in. They're serving an underserved area. They're a school teacher. And literally, they qualify initially for a zero repayment of their student loans. Eventually, they'll have to start paying it. We can't use that. We've got to use a 1% unless it's Freddie Mac. But Fannie Mae and HUD are very strict about that. So,
sorry to interrupt Matt's flow, but listening to Matt talk, it highlights why I advise my buyers to go to a really good lender who knows all of this stuff. I think it's critical when I advise people
rather than going to something online, RocketNet, or not that, well, I shouldn't pick somebody.
Internet lender, you don't know.com.
I know my fellow loan officers here locally. I trust, respect virtually all of them. Whether it's me or somebody else, please use somebody local. They'll treat you right. They will give you a fair interest rate, and they're accountable because they're in the marketplace here.
Sorry. Please continue.
So, yeah, those were two, policies that really didn't help us during this past year. On the positive side, we've got a slightly higher conforming loan limit this year. So 424,100 nationwide is the new limit, up from 417. We haven't had a movement upward since 2006 because values have not increased. Well, there's now recognition that values have now gone past the 2006 level. And then a small benefit for people who are out there that still have not refinanced using the HARP. And that's somebody that might be upside down in their house. So the government realized if they can make the payment right now and they're at a 5% interest rate, but they've lost equity, well, they'd be more likely to continue to making that payment and not go foreclosure if we can give them a lower interest rate, even if they are upside down. The house is worth less than the loan is. And it just makes a lot of sense. So that was extended till September of this year, fortunately, for some of those who have not refinanced yet.
So explain this to me. I'm not going to be able to give you all the answers to the situation because it didn't involve me personally. But a coworker looking for a home found a home that she wanted. It was upside down. What's the proper
short sale?
Short sale. She made an offer in March. It took the bank over 7 or 8 months.
Yeah, easily.
Before they accepted that. Why would a bank sit on a home that it's receiving no money on for that extended period of time before doing something? I mean, I can see 2 months, 3 months, but why would it stay? Why would it keep a piece of property that is going bad? I mean, she drove by that house almost every day. No one was living in it. The house was getting worse. The grass wasn't being cut. You know, all those sorts of things that you can imagine. And yet the bank wouldn't accept her money. They didn't have any other offers on the home because she had her realtor knew the realtor of the person who was under on the sale on the home. And the bank didn't do anything for months and months and months. Why does that sort of issue exist?
First, I'll say that we're coming out of the period where we had a lot of short sales and foreclosures. So I won't say that they are few and far between, but they're much less prominent now in our market than they were 2 or 3 years ago. And a somewhat flippant but an honest answer to that is because 7 months is not an unreasonable amount of time for a short sale. I tell my buyers that every short sale is an adventure. And that if they start to apply logic and reason to the equation, they need to stop. It's just the process that exists for the banks is such that it often is, I've had them close in 2 months. I've also had them close in 15 or 16 months. So it tried to not apply logic to it, and you'll be okay.
I understand your answer of don't apply logic to mm-hmm. it, but if the bank has it as a piece of value.
You're thinking like a logical person. You would think that you would be able to call the bank and say, you've got this asset that's declining in value. You have an offer for X. It makes sense.
But doesn't a bank work under
Rick, I've read stories that it costs $80,000 for a bank to foreclose on a property. And sometimes they will not take an offer that's $30,000 less than what is owed. So they're looking at having an even greater loss, and they will not logically accept what's put in front of them. So, I'm not meaning to be flippant, but the system that exists for that process is profoundly inefficient. And because.
Well, in the end.
Did she get it?
In the end, she did.
Well.
And
a good ending to a frustrating process.
Good ending to a very frustrating process for her. 11:41 here on the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Our guest, Jim Duncan, Matt Hodges, as we talk about the local economy and the real estate market, even the parts we can't understand. And back in action today on the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. A gray winter day, not as cold as it certainly could be. Thank you for tuning in. Next week, Dan Gould will be here covering for me. Hope you'll check in with Dan here on Sunday. Guys, as we continue to talk about the local real estate market, Jim, you had something about traffic and human settlement patterns in the area. Is this all part about the urban ring?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, and I'll put this chart up later on my site. You look at the number of houses, the residential houses that are in the approved pipeline in Albemarle County. You can sort of draw some correlations from where people are living. But my point on that was, you know, that since I've been doing this, you know, the threshold for most of my buyers, and again, it's through my myopic lens, is that they want to be under 20-ish minutes from X. And 15 years ago, that 20 minutes was a certain distance away, and now that 20 minutes is a shorter distance, but it takes them the same amount of time. So the constant has been the 20-ish minutes from work to home or what have you, but as developments have popped up, you're seeing that each region is becoming much more self-sufficient. I mean, Crozet is remarkably self-sufficient right now, save for, you know, jobs. 29 North, Hollymead, you've got a number of developments are coming up there. Brook Hill at the corner of Polo Downs Road. North Point eventually will come up at, on the other side of 29. And, you know, many in between. Berkmar Drive is going to be opening up soon. That extension back there behind the Super Walmart back there.
Sam's Club.
Yeah, and then you look at the stuff that's happening, you know, around Wegmans. I mean, the Wegmans, for years we've been talking about the Wegmans is coming, and it's here, and it's opened up that side of Charlottesville in a remarkable way. I mean, a lot of people now don't need to go anywhere other than Wegmans in downtown Charlottesville. A friend of mine said in a meeting months ago that he thought that the Wegmans and that shopping center opening was going to have a greater impact on traffic patterns in the city, in the urban ring of the county, than did the Metrocake Parkway, John Warner Parkway. You know, time will tell, but I think that people are looking at, you know, where they want to be, and one of the reasons that people come to the Charlottesville area is to have a better quality of life, a slightly slower pace, a commute that's not 45 minutes or an hour each way. People want to be able to, if their kid gets sick at school, go pick them up. Now, you know, a lot of localities around the country, that's not an option. So, you know, looking at the human settlement patterns, people are choosing the where, they're choosing the lifestyle that they want to live, and then they're kind of choosing the house in a lot of ways. So they're evaluating the day-to-day lifestyle, and then they're choosing the house. We can almost always find a house that fits, but, you know, your immediate surroundings beyond the four corners of the property is something that takes a lot more time to figure out.
Matt, one of the things, you know, the area I grew up in, down on the bay, in the water, flood insurance has become a big issue there with some of the changes. You put a note out about how the FHA has a recent reduction in annual mortgage insurance and its effect on affordability. Talk about that, because flood insurance down in my hometown area has had, that's a big topic of discussion. So explain your note here.
Yeah, well, the flood insurance is really a non-actor here at all.
Right.
Understood.
Okay. But sure. It's a different, similar topic, similar issue in a different manner.
The reduction in the mortgage insurance, the annual premium, is going to have a very positive effect for home buyers. And it's going to make HUD and FHA more competitive with the low down payment programs. USDA, believe it or not, USDA, Department of Agriculture, has a rural housing program. And it is rural housing, meaning it can't be used in the city. But they've got very low premiums. It's 1% up front that you pay typically onto the loan amount. FHA is at 1.75, so it's still not as competitive. And USDA decreased their annual from 0.5 to 0.35. So HUD is trying to catch up and be competitive in that marketplace. But if I've got clients that are low down payment, I'm looking very strongly at USDA because it's a better priced program, basically for the same interest rate. It's a positive step that FHA is doing right now. And I don't know whether they can't look at the overall costs because of the size of their organization, because they can't seem to get in front of themselves. But at least the step that they're taking is a positive one. If you look at the numbers, a $300,000 mortgage with this reduction is $62 a month. Not a huge amount, but still it's as Jim mentioned earlier, it may be two fill-ups of your gas tank. It could be another trip to Wegmans. It could be whatever. So I'm happy that HUD has moved on reduction in their costs there, and I'm very hopeful that the new administration does not reverse that.
What are some of these things that people, when you get started to buy your first home, and you may start by going onto the website and pulling up your mortgage calculator, mm-hmm. and looking around, because you can go to, is it the CAAR website where you can look around and sort of do your own search for homes that are available?
Or, you know, nestrealty.com.
I was just before, I wasn't going to turn people away.
Or realcentralva.com.
I was just sort of, for the people who are in their first week and who want to sort of get their toes wet before.
It's mycar.com, mycaar.com.
And so, you know, you're just like, okay, so I want to go to Jim Duncan, but I want to be able to tell him that this is the area that I'm interested in, and I think this is what I can afford.
Right? Okay.
But then you realize these are the things you haven't thought about in your finances, that I need mortgage insurance and I need. And what else have you not thought of?
Yeah, I had a client the other day say, well, why is your quote so much higher than the online version? And she gave me the exact number. I said, well, because that exact number is your principal and interest. The online calculators are only as valuable as the data that you give it and that you receive back and analyze.
So, I mean, years ago when I was, many years ago, I was doing computer stuff, we would call it GIGO, garbage in, garbage out.
Right.
If you don't know as a buyer to put in, PITI, principal, interest, taxes, insurance, if you don't know to put in annual property taxes and the homeowner's insurance, you're going to say, well, my mortgage payment is going to be $1,200. And then it's like, oh, why is it $1,800 or whatever that number is? But from a steps perspective, I think that, a lot of my buyers and sellers, a lot of realtors might hate me for saying this, but they go to Zillow to start, and I think it's a great place to learn about the market and the what is going on in the market, from a accuracy of information and from a houses on the market right now. I would dissuade you vehemently. There's one house on the market that sold 3 months ago. My buyers keep emailing me saying, "Why can I not see this house?" And I keep saying, "Because it sold, but it's still on Zillow. I know it sold." So, I mean, I think there's that. But I think you start with the online stuff. I mean, we all do. We're all going to go to Google. We're all going to go to Zillow. We're all going to find our way to Nest site. But then I think it's a matter of finding a good realtor with whom you trust. I had one yesterday say, we've sold five houses over our lifetime, and you're the first realtor who gets it. That's me, and that's me with those buyers. Every buyer, I think, needs a realtor who gets them. And I'm not going to be a fit for everybody. Not every realtor is. I think it's a matter of evaluating which realtor is going to be a good fit for that buyer so that the buyer feels comfortable asking their dumb questions. If you haven't done this in, 20 years, a lot's changed. And then you find your way to a really good local lender. I mean, it's something that I've beaten people over the head for years. I mean, having a Matt or one of the other guys that I recommend to go and say, hey, Matt, what's this MI thing I keep seeing online? Well, it's mortgage insurance, and this is how it affects you. So I think that having, and when I have my cough a couple weeks ago, I went to my doctor. I didn't Google it. If I Googled it, I thought I would have had something horrific that was going to kill me in 12 minutes. But I went to a professional who was going to be able to discern what was wrong with me. So So I think that the short answer is, if you're looking to buy or sell, you find, you do your initial research, you get your basic questions, answered, and then you find a professional you trust and feel good with to help walk you through that. And that's for a lot of people, it's more than just going to an open house and talking to the first realtor you meet. It's evaluating people, it's talking to your peers and walking through that evaluation process, because it took me a couple of years to figure out the gravity of what it is that Matt and I are tasked with. For better or worse, the decisions that buyers and sellers make based on the advice that we give will directly impact the rest of their lives. And frequently it'll affect the rest of their kids' lives. And I joke that I say that's the part that I really care about, is the kids, because the parents are fairly intelligent people, but the kids are helpless. And that's, frankly, it's a humbling and scary thing to understand that if you buy this house on this street, in the second day on the market, that's going to affect the, next 10, 15, 25 years of your life. So I think that buyers need to understand the gravity of the task that they're undertaking, and find a trusted professional to counsel them through that process, because there's a lot that goes into it. And it's more than just, clicking on Zillow and saying, well, if you like this, you might like this. Maybe. That might work. But I think having a trusted professional to answer those questions and help pose questions back to help work through those questions you don't know to ask. One of the stories I wrote a few months ago was, what questions should buyers be asking? Because there's a lot of stuff that, you just don't, if you don't do this as a profession, you don't know what questions to ask. And I think that it's easy to say, well, I found a mortgage quote from 1-800 thing online. But again, for me, I think that having someone that if there's an issue that comes up in the process, one of the people that I recommend to my clients, one of the lenders, they're going to alert me. They're going to say, well, this is going on. We need to be prepared for this, rather than 2 days before closing, get a email from generic lender online saying, oh, by the way, we can't close. There's one lender in particular, won't mention a name, last year neglected to fund at least 3 loans. I mean, that's profound. And I can't even put into words how bad that is. So I think that having trusted people you can walk into their office and look them in the eye and say, I've got this question. How can you help me? And that's one reason, I recommend people I know and trust to do the right thing for the consumer. And Matt, is good.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Again, our guest today, Jim Duncan, realtor, broker, partner with Nest Realty, and Matt Hodges, Charlottesville sales manager with Presidential Bank Mortgage. It is 11:55, just a few minutes left with our guys today as we talk about the local economy and real estate. Jim, you and I talked a bit about this out front before Matt got here. The growth in the percentage of the family dollars that is being spent in the house, whether that's the purchase of the house, the mortgage, the, what did you call it? The PITY?
PITI, the pity payment.
Yes.
The percentage of income going to housing, whether it's renting or owning.
And how that has changed over the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And how that increases for certainly a percentage of people moving from elsewhere to the Charlottesville-Albemarle area. I'm just, we always talk about how Charlottesville-Albemarle is an expensive place to live.
Mm-hmm.
People who live here are giving up other parts of their life to live here, correct?
Absolutely.
I mean, if you choose to live here and you are paying more for your house, then you have less money to spend in other things. And whether that's in savings for the future or less money to send your kids to an independent private school or wherever you might, you know, less family vacation, or you just can't go to Wegmans, so you need to go to Food Lion across the street. How do you, each of you, you know, I would think that these questions come up at, my gosh, I was only paying such and such. What? That two-bedroom house costs this? What are the conversations that you have?
Naturally, I wrote a story about this a few years ago, and it was, why is real estate in Charlottesville so much more expensive than where I'm from? In the easy answer, and it's not a cop-out, is because. You know, I look at my buyer and say, because you're here.
Didn't you use that same answer for the bank?
Many times. And you know, it's the...
You're very efficient with your answers.
Yeah, I like that. I think that, you know, the demand. People choose to come to the Charlottesville area, and if you have more demand than you have supply, that's going to cause prices to go up. And we've been I think I started practicing real estate in 2001. And, you know, I think we got the best place to live in North America in 2004. And ever since then, through my lens, we've been a very high demand place to be. So you have people who love living in Charlottesville. They target Charlottesville as where they want their job to be, and they come here. And I think that it's just the simple answer is supply and demand. More demand than there is supply.
Matt? And I'd actually say something positive about the influx of homeowners coming from different areas, California, Silicon Valley, D.C., from New York City. They're actually finding bargains based on what they're used to, and they still have their salary because they're telecommuting. So what Jim said earlier about, hey, if you're within that broadband range and it's somewhat limited, so their search criteria is limited, they're going to find something that is effective. Its cost is within their realm. And in fact, what I see is them not pushing their debt to income ratios, which Fannie and Freddie will allow you to go to 45% of your gross income. They're in the 30s. So I'm actually seeing people being more conservative about what they're buying and what their debt to income ratios. I'm not worried about that future
bubble.
And
I'm having a lot more of my buyers are finally able to, you know, I've been saying this for years, but for the last few years, they've actually been doing this and they're qualifying for the mortgage based on one income.
Real quick, because I got to go. Debt-to-income ratio is 45%. What was it 20 years ago that was allowable?
Well, it was 28-36. 28% of your gross income to your house, 36 to all of your debts, including the house. But it was more of a guideline than a hard rule.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
You can find Jim Duncan's blog, realcentralva.com. These guys will be back on in the future.
What?
Again. Thanks, Rick.
It's part of the requirement. Call the police.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.